So today's sutta is a scary one. Fear and dread. So maybe we should put the lights off, shouldn't we, sir? No, can't do that. I won't be able to read, neither would you. So this is a nice sutta. It doesn't really sort of resonate when you live in a forest in Australia, because the only dangerous animals here are the kangaroos, and they're not noted for killing and eating people. So, but if you are in the jungles in, I remember sometimes the jungles in Thailand or in Sri Lanka or in Burma, there are sort of real animals which will eat you, and sometimes people do get eaten. So because of that, some of those forests are scary. But again, we don't really need to do that, worry about that here, because it's a very safe forest. And the main purpose of the story is just saying that if you have got a very pure mind, a good mind, it means that you don't get scared when you're in solitude, especially in dangerous places. It's a sense that you have this confidence inside of you to know that because of the goodness of your conduct, you don't have to fear anything. And that may not really affect you when you're in the forest, but these days the dangerous places are in the city, maybe late at night. So as long as you have got all of these good qualities, you've got none of the bad qualities, wherever you go, you won't have fear and dread, even in the concrete jungles of cities. And in particular, it was just saying one of the greatest ways of overcoming that fear and dread is having good meditation. And the beginning part is very good to say that if you didn't have good meditation, staying alone, staying in solitude will drive you crazy. And it's very important that when we do allow you to do retreats, many of you have done silent retreats by yourself, and you know that sometimes if you haven't got your act together and you don't know how to meditate and become peaceful, sometimes it does drive you a little bit crazy, which is why that sometimes we don't allow people to do too long retreats until we know that they've got some good meditation. And then you can do long retreats. So that's just the basics of the sutta. So here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was living at Sarvati in the Jetavana, that's Jeta Grove, Anathapindika's park. Then the Brahmin, Janusoni, went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When his courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side. And because it says he had just exchanged greetings and had courteous and amiable talk, that signifies he wasn't a disciple of the Buddha, but still respected him. So when he sat down at one side, and you see even here, it's in the Buddhist tradition, you never sit in front of the monk. You always sit to this side or that side. It's a very nice way of doing things. Because sometimes it does happen. Sometimes you're, say, giving a talk in Nolamara, and sometimes somebody sits right in front of you. And it really means that they're really seeking attention. And so it feels a bit uncomfortable. So it's nice when actually you sit this side or that side. And that's a beautiful way of doing things. That's why we do it here. So he sat down at one side and said, Master Gotama, when clansmen, in other words, with good people, have gone forth from the home life into homelessness. And what does it mean, homelessness? What's the Pali word for homelessness? Anagarika, yeah. So you're Anagarikas. You've got no home. They go from home life into homelessness out of faith in Master Gotama. So he's not calling him the Buddha here, calling him Master Gotama. Do they have Master Gotama for their leader, their helper, and their guide? And do these people follow the example of Master Gotama? That is so, Brahmin, that is so. When clansmen have gone forth from the home life into homelessness out of faith in me, They have me for their leader, their helper, and their guide. And these people follow my example. You see, a leader, but I like to think about the helper and a guide. And they follow the example. So now we get to the point of it. But Master Gotama, remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest are hard to endure. Seclusion is hard to practice. It is hard to enjoy solitude. One would think the jungles must rob a monk of their mind if they have no stillness, no samadhi. I always like that sort of statement, because I remember meeting, I've told you before, I think in the talk recently, meeting these rishis in Thailand who had gone out into the jungles, into the caves for years at a time. And it was true, it robbed them of their mind because they were crazy as coots. But that's what happens sometimes. You've got to be very careful. And sometimes, I remember when I did my 6 month retreat in solitude, 6 months not seeing anyone or speaking to somebody, I could do that because I did have samadhi. But some people, apparently, they were waiting for me to emerge after my 6 months solitary retreat to see if I had these big wild eyes and this long hair and as crazy as anything. And they were quite actually, a bit few were disappointed that, you know, I was just ordinary, just sort of peaceful Ajahn Brahm and not some crazy guy. But you can see, if you haven't got samadhi, it can drive you crazy. So, remote jungle thicket resting places in a forest are hard to endure. One would think that the jungles must rob a monk of their mind if they have no stillness, no concentration. That is so, Brahmin, replies the Buddha. That is so. Remote jungle thicket resting places in a forest are hard to endure. Seclusion is hard to practice and it's hard to enjoy solitude. One would think the jungle must rob a monk of their mind if they have no samadhi. And again, this is remote enough. If you haven't got any samadhi and you join meditation, basically there's nothing much to do, especially at this time of the year. So, you know, what else are you going to do? So that's why that every now and again, you know, we have sort of interviews, you know, you have people, you come and do a few jobs, and sometimes if you didn't do those few jobs, and the driving or the kitchen or the other duties which you have at the beginning of your life in the monastery, it would drive you crazy. Because solitude is not an easy thing to practice. It is when you have stillness, samadhi, and then you enjoy your solitude. But if you don't have any stillness, you have a restless mind, then you don't know where you're going to go with that restless mind. And that's what the Buddha is saying. Now, paragraph 3, any comments on that? Paragraph 3. Before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, they see in the Theravada tradition, they always, this is a phrase, whenever you mention bodhisattva, it's always preceded by an unenlightened bodhisattva. I too consider thus, remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest are hard to endure. The jungles must rob a monk of their mind if they have no concentration, no samadhi. I prefer the word stillness. I consider thus, whenever recluses or Brahmins, unpurified in bodily conduct, resort to remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest, then owing to the defects of their unpurified bodily conduct, these good recluses and Brahmins evoke unwholesome fear and dread. So it's not just stillness, it's like your purity of conduct. If you're a really good person, then even that just sila, that purity of conduct, that sort of takes away a lot of the fear. And it's very interesting to know that. One of the reasons is because, you know, you've done lots of good karma, you're a good person, and even the animals will know that and they won't harm you. So even I remember myself being in those forests and those jungles in Thailand, you know, because you kept good sila, you weren't really afraid. It's amazing, you weren't really afraid of the snakes or other beings. You just had lots of metta, so you just gave them metta, loving kindness, and they left you alone. I told all the stories with the snakes. They crawl over you, you step on them, and they jump one way, you jump another way. Sometimes you urinate on them. But, you know, they were just fine. So it's because you had loving kindness and metta towards them. Yeah? Here, go on.
Remember how you mentioned Ajahn Chah, someone, one of the
Joined the army.
So just could you clarify? Because I just assume from that that once you're born, you go to city, you have the same chance of getting, let's say, run over or injured or attacked as anybody else, or is it saying that your good morality actually affects that you have a less likely chance?
Well, yeah, because these are animals who are liable to do you damage in the jungle. So, you know, if you have loving kindness towards, say, the snake won't harm you. But if you have loving kindness towards the car which is coming towards you, the car won't know what you're doing or will hit you anyway. So it's the fact that these are, the dangers in the city are not quite the same as the dangers in the jungle.
You said that we extend it to other things, so we don't extend it to other things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can extend it to a car, but I don't think it's really going to help that much. But if you do it to, like, an elephant or a bear, of course, you know, that will affect those animals. They'll feel it.
This practice of morality is just making us not have fear, but the probability of us being injured is the same.
No, the probability of being injured will be much less.
I mean, in the city.
Oh, in the city, yeah.
Right,
yeah. Okay. But even in the city, I mean, there was one story I was told a long time ago. And this was, you know, maybe 35 years ago, 40 years ago. There was this Indian guru, and he was walking in one of the worst parts of New York, and these people tried to mug him. So, you know, these young people, they sort of surrounded him, got out their knife, and say, "Give me your wallet." Mac, apparently, they called him. Not sort of, you know, your holiness, but they just called him Mac. And he said, "Look, I don't have any money, I'm a holy man, don't give us that, we'll knife you." But then as he started talking to these people, he had no fear, he was a good person. And in the end, they just not only let him go, but they said, "No, I'm sorry sir, we made a mistake." And he told his disciples, and his disciples told the newspapers, and it got in the news. And you know, the police were just really quite surprised that these guys would call him sir, and would actually let him go. He just said, "No, because of my purity of conduct, because I was a good person, they would not harm me, and I didn't have any fear." So that was a case, one case which I heard a long time ago, where if you're a good person, you know, people won't harm you. So I think it's in the cities good too.
Okay.
Yeah.
It says the evoke unwholesome fear and dread. Does it have a meaning, unwholesome, or just...
Oh yeah, because there is a wholesome, like, fear, like the fear of, like, a forest fire. You don't just sit there, "I'm not afraid," and then you get out of the way. Yeah, you know, there is a wholesome fear.
Yeah, so it is actually there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, in the time of the early Sangha, you know, there weren't like city temples where people were ordained. They went right into the forest, right?
Yeah, there were both. There were both the because the Chaitawana monastery. It's very clear where that is, and you know, you can go and visit there, and you can see where the city is. It was in walking distance. You know, it was maybe a kilometre or two away. That's all. So
those bhikkhus would.
But they would go.
There were options for bhikkhus who didn't have some money.
Yeah. So they'd be in the city temples, and then usually for about 4 or 5 years, and then they'd be allowed to go off by themselves into the jungles. So they had, even those times, they had the monks and the nuns who stayed in the temples. You know, it wasn't actually in the city, it was close to the city. And then they had the ones who went further away, in the forest, in the jungles. And so... Okay, I consider it does. Okay,
I'm sure,
yeah.
Suppose
you
have a fear, such as a phobia, like arachnophobia, fear of spiders.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
You might be a very good person, but you still have arachnophobia.
That's right, yeah. So that's, you know, sometimes you wonder where that actually comes from. Some, most psychologists would say some sort of unpleasant experience when you were very small, or maybe previous life. So Yeah, if you have those sort of phobias, then but just the purity of your conduct. You know, I had the usual fear of spiders, but not sort of great ones. But then, you know, when you got to a place like Thailand, you know, you'd have spiders all over you. And, you know, the tarantulas would go on the roof and sometimes fall off and just, you know, go all over your tummy. And, you know, it was actually quite sort of tickly, so quite nice. It's just an interesting sensation. Because you know that we're going to harm you. It was strange, I mean, in the northeast of Thailand, the northeast Thais, they won't be afraid at all of spiders, but they would be terrified of the wall lizards. And it was really strange. The wall lizards, they had this wall lizard phobia. Why, I don't know. And we always thought the wall lizards were very, very cute and very beautiful. They had wonderful markings on them. So, it's, you know, what are you really afraid of? So, but I used to see these really big snakes, and I never really had any fear of snakes, but I have a great sense of like love and care for the snakes. And yeah, there's that big one here. There's a big tiger snake or a dugong. Really huge one, 2.5 meters long. I remember it came to visit me once, and just I was washing my bowl, and just gave it some kindness, and just ignored it, and it sort of turned around. It was had its tail pointed towards me, and just I could have touched it if he wanted to. Had no fear at all of me. It was just in the shade of the kuti, because it was a very hot day, just wanted a bit of respite from the hot sun. So because, you know, you're a good person, those animals aren't going to harm you. But don't worry, it doesn't come out this time of the year, because it's only during the hot weather. Don't know where it is. I think another couple of monks have seen it. Has anyone else seen that big? 2.5? Yeah, you saw it. Yeah, okay, yeah. Lovely animal. So, paragraph 4 again. I consider thus, whenever recklessness of Brahmins unpurified in bodily conduct resort to the remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest, and owing to the defect of their unpurified bodily conduct, these good recklessness and Brahmins invoke unwholesome fear and dread. But the Buddha is saying, but I did not resort to remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest unpurified in bodily conduct. I am purified in bodily conduct. And I resort to remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest as one of the noble ones with bodily conduct purified. Seeing in myself this purity of bodily conduct, I found great solace in dwelling in the forest. So it's not just a lack of fear, but just a sense of a solace and sense of peace and happiness. It is true, this, you know, in the forest, in the jungles, if you can not be afraid of all those animals, there is a very peaceful and calm abiding. There's not many people bothering you.
It looks like the Buddha was referring to himself as a noble one when he was Bodhisattva. So that suggests he wasn't starting from scratch.
Indeed. So that's one of the reasons which you picked up. He said, and this is before his enlightenment, he was, I consider thus, I resort to the remote jungle thicket resting place in the forest as one of the noble ones. And so it does actually seem to be saying that as a bodhisattva, he wasn't fully enlightened yet, he was unenlightened. That's anabhisambuddho, that means not fully enlightened, but he was still a noble one. Which is one of the reasons why I mentioned is quite a lot of evidence suggesting he was a Sakadagami when he was born. So seeing in myself as purity of bodily conduct, I found great solace. I considered thus, whenever recklessness and Brahmins unpurified in verbal conduct, unpurified in mental conduct, unpurified in livelihood, resort to the remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest, they evoke unwholesome fear and dread. But I am purified in verbal conduct, mental conduct, and right livelihood, so I resort to remote jungle thicket places, thicket resting places in the forest as one of the noble ones, with my verbal conduct, mental conduct, and livelihood purified. Seeing in myself this purity of livelihood, I found great solace in dwelling in the forest. So just seeing just those things creates the sense of, you know, the lack of fear. What you've got to fear, you're a good person. It may also be just understanding just, you know, karma, and that because that the three types of bad karma, which is bad bodily conduct, verbal conduct, and mental conduct, because those are purified, and that, you know, it's unlikely to be any sort of bad karmic results.
I don't know how the I guess they're not really constructing an idea of who they are, but is it a sense of peace that they have or something?
Now remember that even though they know that there is no self in there, they still have the perception and sometimes the thought of an I am. So they will still have some fear.
So when they reflect on their conduct, is it like taking that as an identity, or is it just this?
No, it's just the causes. So they've had wonderful causes, there's no bad causes. So there's no bad causes there, and it's unlikely to be any bad results. So, you know, they're sort of, you know, ahead of the game, so they're likely to survive the jungle thickets with no problem at all. Yes, Brendan?
When he says that he was purified in mental conduct,
yeah.
Does it mean like he never had an unwholesome thought?
Ah, no, because it means that you may have had an unwholesome thought, but a long time ago. So purified in mental conduct, again, is not sort of having thoughts of, you know, ill will or craving. So it's a very good point there, because the only time you really are purified totally in mental conduct, you know, is when you are now fully enlightened. So basically, the mental conduct is, you know, pretty good, but maybe not perfect before you're fully enlightened. So just saying that, just the some of the power of being a good person, being a sort of a moral person. You know, there is a sense of automatically being quite secure in even difficult places. I think there's a bit of each there, but I think it's pointing to here that there is something, a correlation between just being a pure person and the sense of safety, no matter where you are. Even it may not be that you believe in the karma, but just the very fact that you're a good person, maybe other people see that and they won't harm you. Or animals won't harm you, simply because you're a good person. Even if they may not know you, never seen you before in their life, just your goodness gives, I suppose, other people, you know, your fearlessness gives other people a sense of fearlessness, so they leave you alone.
So even if that person has fear, because they, the animals don't harm them?
Yeah, because they're a good person, it's just the animals will probably pick that up. Because, you know, you can pick that up, each one of you. If, you know, you see a good person come into the room, you can actually sense it. And if they're really like an evil person, like a harmful person, you can sense that sometimes. This is a bad person comes into the room. I remember Sadie Lee's brother, Venerable Dhamma Wuto. He said he was visiting a person's house. He's a monk. And the executioner of Malaysia came into the house. He's the hangman, because they still hang people there. He didn't know who he was, but he felt straight away that this is a really sort of unpleasant person. And then he found out that was a guy who sort of pulls the lever and hangs people. So, you know, sometimes you can sense that this is a really nice person coming in, and sometimes it's a very dangerous person. So I think if you can do that, maybe other people and animals can actually pick up you're a good person or a bad person. I consider thus, whatever recluses or Brahmins who are covetous and full of lust go into the forest, then they will have unwholesome fear and dread. But if they don't have covetousness and lust, they won't have that fear and dread. When they have a mind of ill will and intentions of hate, they will get fear and dread. But when you have loving kindness, you don't have that. And you see straight away, that's the opposite of ill will and hatred, of loving kindness. Those ones who are overcome by sloth and torpor may have unwholesome fear and dread. Well, you don't have sloth and torpor, you are without that unwholesome fear and dread. Or overcome with restlessness and unpeaceful in mind, you have unwholesome fear and dread. When you have a peaceful mind, then you are without fear and dread. Uncertain and doubting, you will have unwholesome fear and dread. But he has gone beyond doubt, showing that, you know, this is a stream winner, then you don't have unwholesome fear and dread. And you will see that, what are those last five called?
Five
hindrances, yeah. So say, when you have any of those hindrances, and they're very strong, it means you are likely to get unwholesome fear and dread. And without those hindrances, then you don't get fear and dread. It's one of the reasons why, like a person who's enlightened, they don't have those hindrances, so they don't get afraid. And that's one of the ways we try and find out if a person's enlightened or not, to see if they get afraid. So you put them in a pit with snakes and see if they're afraid. So that's a test whether you're enlightened or not. So if anyone comes up to me in the children's retreat and they say they're enlightened, I say, okay, we'll do the test now. We can't find any snakes over here. Maybe we can get some white-tailed spiders and red-backed spiders. I don't know what we can find. But if you haven't got these hindrances, it was saying that you don't have fear. That's so true, that if you haven't been in nice samadhi and get lots of peace, then of course there's no fear at all. And we all know that, hopefully you know that lovely story of one of the monks, Ajahn Gunha, you all know him and his snake story. He was sitting in the jungle with all these other monks when a king cobra came up to him. And those king cobras, as I said in my book, they had a nickname for them in Thailand at the time, and they were called the one-step snake. That was a nickname. And the reason why they were called the one-step snake was because if they bit you, that's all you had left to live, one step, and then you died. So that was really venomous, king cobra. And so this king cobra came up, such a big snake, and all the monks, they sort of opened their eyes, and it came right up to Ajahn Gunha. And it lifted up its head and opened its hood right in front of his nose. And the question is, would you have unwholesome fear and dread? That would be a sign you've still got hindrances and weren't practicing well. But this monk, you know, he's a really great meditator. What he did was lifted up his hand and patted the snake on the head and said, thank you so much for coming to visit me. And that snake was just enjoying every moment, because it's so rare to get a pat on the head by a lovely monk like Ajahn Gunha. So there was the snake having his head patted, I don't know for how many minutes. And after he got his head patted, apparently he closed his hood, put his head down, and went to see one of the other monks to get a patting. And the other monk said, no way, you go back to Ajahn Gunha. I'm not going to do that. And that was the story. But of course that was a really good sign, that was a really good monk. He didn't have any fear and dread. And sometimes, even if you do have fear and dread normal times, sometimes when you come out of samadhi, you just have no fear and dread at all. So, or if you're given to self-praise and disparagement of others, it's going to give unwholesome fear and dread. Now, actually, not just the five precepts, but these other really nice things which we shouldn't really encourage. I am the best monk in the whole world. And all those other monks, they're just hopeless and they're just ridiculous. They just don't know what they're doing. Or I am the best anagarika. All those other anagarikas, they're just not practicing at all. They're just really disgusted with them. They just sit around and just talk all day asleep. Don't know what they get up to. They're not really practicing. And actually, I see that so often, sort of with, unfortunately, with young monks, praising themselves and disparaging others. And it's what we call, or what that Chogyam Trungpa says, spiritual materialism. No, I've got the most. I'm enlightened. You're not. But I am. No, no. You're not, but I am. So this self-praise and disparagement of others, please never be. Especially disparagement of others. That's a very Western thing, always putting other people down. You know, you just, Ajahn Brahm, yeah, look how, you know, he eats too much, he can't be enlightened. Yeah, Ajahn Mahabur, he believes in the Amitajitta, he can't be enlightened. Yeah, sort of, you know, Ajahn Yanadamo, you know, he can't be enlightened. Yeah, Ajahn Sumedho, he just believes in the ground of all being, he can't be enlightened. And you just put everybody else down, so that, you know, that makes you feel good. And of course, that's terrible, terrible conceit. So we don't go around praising ourselves and disparaging others. And I point that out there, that's obviously not a thing which is encouraged by the Buddha. In fact, he says it's a hindrance, it's a defilement. So don't go around praising yourself and disparaging anybody else. Someone is subject to alarm and terror, and I am free from trepidation. It tells me that some people are just so paranoid. Anything happens, and they're just alarm and terror. Or desirous of gain, honor, and renown. And the Buddha says, I have few wishes. That's the opposite of being desirous of gain, honor, and renown. And I'm very pleased with myself. This is self-praise again I'm doing. Because it's my birthday soon. And again, people keep asking me, what do you want? Do you want gain, honor, renown? No, you just have few wishes. Or if you're lazy and wanting in energy, but no, I'm energetic, unmindful, not fully aware, I'm established in mindfulness, unconcentrated with straying minds. Now that's really, again, shows you what this concentration means. It's stillness, not the mind straying, being still. So stillness with straying minds, I am possessed of stillness. And lastly, I consider thus, whenever recluses or Brahmins devoid of wisdom, drivellers, that's a lovely word, drivellers, which means you just say all sorts of stupid things, and just, you know, almost like dribble as well. Resort to remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest, and owing to the defect of their being devoid of wisdom and drivellers, these good recluses and Brahmins invoke unwholesome fear and dread. But I do not resort to remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest devoid of wisdom, a driveller. I'm possessed of wisdom. I resort to the remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest as one of the noble ones possessed of wisdom. Seeing in myself this possession of wisdom, I found great solace in dwelling in the forest. So if you like to go on retreat, live by yourself, like in the forest, then these are the things you should make sure that you have developed. You are pure in bodily, verbal, mental conduct, have right livelihood, not be covetousness and full of lust, not have ill will or intentions of hate, not have sloth and torpor, restlessness, or a doubt, and not praising yourself, disparaging others, not subject to alarm and terror, not desirous of gain, honor, and renown, not lazy, wanting in energy, not mindful, no, not still. If you've got any of those, don't go and retreat. But if you have none of those, then you can go and retreat and enjoy yourself and get great solace and peace. Oh, what a wonderful time. And also wise as well. I consider thus. Oh, yes?
How do you overcome alarm and terror?
Alarm and terror. You don't own this body. You're going to die anyway. So the sooner you get eaten by a tiger, it means you don't have to enjoy old age. Or whatever, I don't know. Another thing is, it's not going to happen anyway. Sort of, you know, it's just, you know, maybe sort of if I was really young, sort of, you know, I'm old, me and tough. And just, so you're not going to get eaten by a tiger. They're like someone nice and young and juicy, like, you know, like the difference between a lamb and mutton. So a self-respecting tiger wouldn't eat you. You know, you're so old, Richard, so. Yeah? Yeah.
Looking at the good parts of myself. And I notice, like, for instance, if I mention, let's say to a friend or something, or to my mom, oh, I did this, like recollecting the good qualities, then it just helps me reinforce that. So how do you differentiate, like, for instance, what you said, oh, okay, I'm good because I don't do this. So
praise the qualities, not the person. Praise the qualities, not the person. And disparage the bad conduct, but not the person. So it's when we disparage people. So you say, no, it's very good to be, it's great to be energetic. So you praise your energy, you praise your inquiring mind, you praise your stillness. And you disparage sort of, you know, like anger or ill will or jealousy. That's actually from the Arana Vibhanga Sutta. So he said, never say, oh, just those monks are stupid, you know, because they sleep too much. You say, sleeping too much is a cause of stupidity. And that way there's never any conflict, because you're never associating bad conduct with people or good conduct with people. You're just disparaging conduct or praising conduct. You never say, oh, the Anagarikas are too lazy. You just say, no, lazy Anagarikas, you know, are just a problem. But you don't actually say, the Anagarikas here are lazy. There's a lot of difference there. Well, they're not lazy, they're very good. Okay. So he was quite happy to stay in the forest because of those good qualities. So if you've got those good qualities, the forest does not rob the mind, and you like to stay alone in the forest. I consider thus, there are the specially auspicious nights of the 14th, the 15th, and the 8th of the fortnight. Those are, you know, the Uposatha days, you know, the times, you know, in, say in Thailand, the One Pra, the Poya days in Sri Lanka. So these are the days when people would go to the temple, just basically the Sabbath days. In other words, the moon days. Yes?
If somebody has those qualities that are caused by fear and dread, does that mean that if they go to a forest with those qualities, are they practicing an ascetic path rather than the middle way? And for them, is the middle way something else apart from that?
Well, you've come out later on and say sometimes the Buddha actually just face the fear. So, you know, make sure you've got those good qualities first of all, and then you are equipped to face fear and dread. So it's a bit of wisdom, and it's, you know, it's too ascetic in a sense. It's not going to work, it's just going to make things worse. You know, if you haven't got those qualities and say, I'm going to go and face a tiger anyway. There's another of those tiger stories, which this was one of the old monks told me. Now, there was this monk who was walking, you know, on the Charika, which was Tudong, just walking from place to place. And it was the custom that when you got to a place, you would check in with the headman of the local village first of all. And the reason he did that, you know, you'd say that, you know, I've just arrived, is there any nice place in the jungle or close by where there's some water where I can rest tonight? And also meant that, you know, you were telling the villagers you'll be there in the following morning for alms round. So, you know, just telling them that in a nice way that, you know, you want to be fed tomorrow. Because otherwise they wouldn't know and they wouldn't have any food prepared for you. So that was a custom, very practical. So this monk, he got to this village and, you know, checked in with the headman, and the headman said, look, it's best if you stay in the village because there's a tiger around, and the tiger has actually killed many of our buffalo and a couple of our kids as well. So it's, you know, very dangerous. So, you know, don't stay outside. Stay with us in the village. And he said, no, I'm a forest monk, I'm not afraid of tiger. And he said, are you sure? He said, yeah, I'm not afraid of tiger, I'm going to face the tiger. And so the villagers were quite impressed. So they took him, you know, just outside the village, where the tiger trail was, you know, because the tigers make the trails through the jungle. And he said, well, if you really want to face a tiger, there's a good chance, you know, this is the path he comes across. So he said, okay. So he set up his, like, mosquito net, and, you know, the umbrella, the Thai tradition, and he camped there. And all the villagers left him there, because they're not going to hang out where the tiger's coming. They went back into the village. And then that monk was sitting there very peacefully. And this was one of the Thai monks, and they one of the most common ways of meditation is to use the mantra Buddho, along with the breath. So you breathe in, you recite Buddho, breathe out, to Buddho. It's like the old Ajahn Mun tradition. So there he was, just breathing in Buddho, Buddho, really peaceful. But then he heard a sound of an animal coming along the path. Buddho, Buddho, Buddho. And as it came closer, he realized it could be the tiger. Buddho, 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 Buddho. And then his mantra, as he opened his eyes, he saw this huge tiger coming towards him. A huge one. And it was this tiger. So his mantras changed from Buddho, Buddho to tiger, 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 tiger. And the next thing he knew, apparently he didn't know how this happened, he was out of his mosquito net and running towards the village. And instead of just chanting softly, tiger, tiger, he was tiger, 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 in full voice, as he ran for safety to the village. But running is not really permitted for monks. And the reason is, if ever you do try and, like, even for those of you who are novices, it's hard enough to keep your robes on anyway. If you run, your robes fall off. And not just your outer robes, the inner robes fall off as well. And this is what happened to that monk. So by the time he arrived in the village, there was no robes left on him. And he was shouting out, tiger, tiger, tiger. And of course the villagers all sort of, you know, woke up, and they looked through and saw this naked monk running through their streets shouting, tiger, 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 tiger. And it was a monk who was not afraid of tigers. So this is one of the problems. There's sometimes that, you know, you have to make sure that you are ready, you know, to face these things. Because otherwise, if you just think, oh, I can do this, you end up just running through the village naked, shouting tiger. Yeah.
I think in that German takes autobiography.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what he did. Maybe just developed some wisdom, some peace. Could be those tigers, they did eat people. But very rare they ate people, but they did sometimes. Anyway, now that on on those nights, the 14th, 15th, and the 8th, and the 8th of the fortnight. Now, what if on such nights as these, I were to dwell in such awe-inspiring, horrifying abodes as orchard shrines, woodland shrines, and tree shrines? Perhaps I might encounter that fear and dread. Now, of course, those shrines were sort of remote. And the reason there were shrines there, because there was usually these like invisible beings who lived there, like ghosts and demons and stuff. That's why there were shrines there. And so most people would like steer clear of them, but he would go to where the ghosts and the spirits were. And of course, like most people, they're terrified. So what if I went to those horrifying abodes, those orchard shrines, woodland shrines, and tree shrines where the dangerous spirits lived? And while I dwelt there, a wild animal would come up to me, or a peacock would knock off a branch, or the wind would rustle the leaves. And I thought, what now, if this is a fear and dread coming? And I thought, why do I dwell expecting fear and dread? What if I subdue that fear and dread while keeping the same posture that I am when it comes upon me? Now, the one thing which I really like about that is expecting fear and dread. It's when you expect it, that's when it comes. Because a fear and dread is always a fear of something which hasn't happened yet, but what you expect will happen. So if you see the tiger, it hasn't eaten you, it's just a tiger. But the reason you're afraid is because perhaps it will eat me, and you expect it to eat you. That's why you're afraid. all because you've lost your present moment awareness. Yeah.
What does subdue mean?
Means actually to allow it to subside, so it just disappears.
So
it goes.
There's no force involved.
No force, no. But use wisdom. Wisdom power, not willpower. And while I walked, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither stood, nor sat, nor lay down till I had subdued that fear and dread. When I stood, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked, nor sat, nor lay down till I had subdued that fear and dread. When I sat, that fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked, nor stood, nor lay down till I had subdued that fear and dread. Or when I lay down, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked, nor stood, nor sat down till I had subdued that fear and dread. That's the most common way. If you're laying down and you get fear and dread, you usually pull the blankets over your head. And you don't come out until you subdue that fear and dread. No, that's only joking. Sorry. Yes, you got your hand up.
At what part of time in the Buddha's life would this have happened? Is that when he was being aesthetic?
You'd expect the 6 years, yes, before he became enlightened. During that time. Yes?
With fear, so do we subdue the any of the arising emotions there? Or go to the, as you mentioned, or find out the cause of what we expect? Let's say, I expect a car crash, so that's fear. So do you try to like deal with the expectation that might not happen? Or do you deal with the emotion and just calm the emotion down? Because you mentioned...
Well, both. I mean, it's, any sort of trick will do. But, you know, just not expecting anything was giving a huge insight into the nature of fear and dread. So you expect something bad to happen, you expect the fear to come. You're anticipating it. And you're just allowing that old habit just to continue. So instead of like expecting it to get worse, you just stay in the present moment and just let the fear and dread pass away. And so, you know, sometimes, as you know, monks, you know, used to go to places where there were supposed to be ghosts. So I remember just when I was on my walking tour, you know, I went to this monastery. It was in Phupan district in Thailand, and there was this very famous forest monk, Ajahn Suwat. And I stayed there a couple of days for the Patimokkha ceremony. And then afterwards I was going off to Sokonakon, which is about 2 days' walk. And I asked him, are there any caves on the way where I can spend the night? And he said, yes, there is a cave about halfway, but be careful. He said, because there's a ghost in that cave, and it's a dangerous ghost. And this was like one of the great forest monks, and he said, there's a ghost there, and there's a dangerous ghost. I thought, great, where is it? So... I wanted to face the ghost. You know, you're a monk. Let's go and see a real ghost. It'd be great for your stories when you, you know, become a teacher. So he told me where it was. And so when I got there, and out to the village, I asked the village, where's the cave? Because I want to see the ghost. So he told me to this cave, and it was a really sort of really weird cave. It wasn't, you know, it was just like a little opening in the, it was almost like a little hill, and it was like an opening in the hill where the cave was, and you can go quite deep inside there. And there was this old shrine, these, you know, very old Buddha statues. You know, they'd be probably worth a fortune these days, but they'd been in there and no one would dare take them out. When I asked him about the ghost, he said, well, if you go deep into the cave, there's a skeleton there, a human skeleton. Somebody's died in this cave. And so obviously that was where the ghost was. So, you know, as soon as, you know, there was a little spring nearby where I could wash and get some water. And then I sort of went in there and set up my mosquito net and started meditating and waiting for the ghost. It was dark and no one was around. The village was a couple of kilometers away. So if I was in trouble, there was no one to help me. You were alone in this dark cave, knowing there was a skeleton further down the chamber and knowing that there was a ghost, because this was a great time, Mike, and they don't lie. And I waited. And waited, and waited, and of course the ghost never came. So I lay down and went to lay down to go to sleep. And as soon as I lay down, that was when the ghost came. Came running towards me, really fast, and stopped right outside, right next to my... You're not interested in this story? It stopped right next to my, you know, the platform where I was laying down. You know what I did? I sort of said to the ghost, I said, look, now I'm sleeping now, you come at the wrong time, get out of here. Because I've been waiting for all that time, and now it came, you know, just after I was going to sleep. It was not the right time. And that's another my attitude. Just, you know, she goes away, so I just went to sleep. Don't know what the ghost did. It was probably really pissed off at me for not getting scared. So that was my ghost story. So you don't have fear of dread, because you know the ghost can't harm you. They try and make you afraid, that's all. And if you don't go afraid, because that's my sleep time, you should have come earlier. I was waiting for you.
What was the deception of it running? The sound?
Or? No, just like the sound, yeah. The sound of someone running towards you and then stopping right next to you. Not running past, but running and stopping. So anyway, so the point is here, instead of actually giving in to the fear and dread, just keeping the same posture. It helps. Now this is actually a little bit weird. But let's say paragraph 21. There's a lot of comment and discussion about this paragraph. There are Brahmin, some recluses and Brahmins who perceive day when it's night and night when it's day. I say on their part this is an abiding in delusion. But I perceive night when it is night and day when it's day. Rightly speaking, were it to be said of anyone, a being not subject to delusion has appeared in the world for the wealth and happiness of many out of compassion for the world, for the good wealth and happiness of gods and humans. It is of me indeed that rightly speaking this should be said. Now that's really out of context there, and it's a bit really strange. I know that sometimes it's true that I've mentioned this to some of you, that sometimes your perception when you get into samadhi can change and mess around. And I tell many stories that sometimes that, you know, you are meditating and your room is full of light. It is like it's light. No, this it's just you've got your eyes open. And sometimes, and I mention things like you see white towels being black, and you see the walls become like melting chocolate, just dripping down. These are just, you're not going crazy. All this is one of the things which happens when you get into some deep meditation. Your perception, which is so heavily conditioned, you only allow yourself to see the world in, you know, a narrow band of possibilities. Now that perception starts to mess around and play around and see things which aren't supposed to be seen. And it is delusion, because you're not seeing what's real, just perception is messing around and playing around. But for me, it's just, I always think it's nothing to be afraid of, because it usually just passes away pretty quickly in meditation. But it's just one of the things which happens. Remember Ajahn Chah's story of seeing his body just explode, and perceiving his liver on a tree and a heart on another tree. That's just, you know, just what happens. It's just your perception is messing around. Or sometimes people feel their body is just expanding and filling up the whole sala here, the whole hall, or just going into the ground or lifting up. And those are really quite ordinary ones, but you get some very, very weird perceptions. And if that ever happens to you in your meditation, enjoy it, because meditation can be really boring. Especially 3 months in a monastery, you can't watch a movie. This is like your own movie, and it's really weird and wonderful. And just, I say it's good fun. It doesn't last that long, it's only a couple of minutes, and then you just get back to boring normality again. And what it is just your perception becoming free from all of its restrictions. And just sometimes I say it's like a kid who's been with their parents and they go to university, and when they go to university they're free from their parents' control, they just go wild for a few days, you know, until they sort of realise that's not going to help them at all, so then they sort of knuckle down and behave again. So you know, the first time away from home, children can sometimes go a bit wild. So the first time your perception is let loose, then it can go a bit wild before it settles down again. That's all it is. So it is a biting delusion, but sometimes these things happen. Yeah.
On page 4, section 4, the Buddha explains that those with the impure mind,
yeah,
suffer from this fear in the rest of the workplace. And he says this, just on page 903, that he's beyond that. So, put over on the page here in these fear places, he was saying that the fear actually came up.
Yeah. So he wasn't. So, yeah, he's saying he wasn't totally sort of overcome the fear. There's still some he had to overcome. So there's still some fear there. Because again, he wasn't fully enlightened yet. He was talking about the time before he was enlightened. He's also mentioning that, you know, why other monks or nuns or other lay people, because they were talking about, Jadasoni was saying that, you know, you're the leader, you're the guide, you know, and this is what you do. Do you expect other people to do the same? And he's saying, yeah, you can stay in the jungle, but once you've got rid of these unwholesome qualities, it's less likely to have fear and dread. And he said, I had that fear and dread when I was young. I wasn't totally pure. He was now. And this fear and dread sometimes come up, and this is, you know, how he faced it. He went to face it. He went to go and see if he was afraid. So that's why, you know, you are encouraged as monks, especially, I don't know really, because the Thai monks, they were really sort of so scared of ghosts. So in just going to the cremation grounds, that was just a tough thing for a Thai monk to do. You know, for a Western monk, it was no big deal. So, you know, just go to a cremation ground, you know, just, you didn't really have the conditioning. But they would hate it. So whenever a Western monk went to the cremation ground, they thought you were really, really sort of, you know, almost enlightened. What are you talking about? It's just only ghosts, and it's probably won't ever see one anyway. So anyway, that the Buddha actually went to these places, and again, they said just it was just a wild animal would come up, would never do anything to you. A peacock would knock off a branch, or the wind would rustle the leaves. I do remember that one time when I was sitting in a forest, and in the jungle somewhere, and again, you know, you're quite peaceful and calm. You hear these sounds of these animals in the jungle, and this one was coming. And you know, you just noted it mindful, that's only a tiny animal, nothing to worry about, just carry on meditating. And as it came closer, you could actually, you know, it was coming closer towards me. And so in my mindfulness, I was very mindful, just very sort of peaceful. And then the sound was actually, I realised this wasn't a small animal. It was probably like a medium-sized animal, maybe like these little civet cats. You know, but they were quite benign, they wouldn't do any harm to you. So, you know, I just carried on meditating. And then, you know, the noise as it came closer, you know, got louder. And that's when I started getting a bit concerned. You know, this was not like a small animal, this was the largest animal. When it's a long distance away, you can't really notice it very much. And so my mindfulness was really acute. I was listening to it with my eyes closed. And what actually is this? And it was coming really close towards me. I realised that, you know, this was a huge animal. A bear over my eyes, because, you know, sometimes it was a bear they attacked without any provocation. You know, the elephants and the tigers, they'd leave you alone mostly. But, you know, I realised it was a big animal, so I opened my eyes, you know, got out a flashlight trying to look for it. And then I saw it. It was this tiny mouse. And it really shocked me, because I really thought I was being mindful and aware. But I realised that when you have a slightest bit of fear, that just, you know, without you noticing it, that, you know, exaggerates, and your mindfulness, you know, hears a little mouse and it makes it into an elephant. And that really shocked me. That's what fear does, it exaggerates. So what the Buddha was doing is actually seeing that, you know, these may be just a branch or wind rustling the leaves, and fear just, you know, you're mindful, you're listening, and you think you're sort of, you know, being totally aware, but the fear has got into you and just exaggerated it. Yeah.
I was listening to a retreat CD today, and it was saying, you're saying that don't trust the thinking mind.
Yeah.
But you're encouraging a more direct perception without thinking. So in a situation like that, can there still be a thinking process happening even though it's not verbal?
Yeah, it's just the subconscious, I suppose you'd call it. I actually should mention, for those of you staying in the ladies' quarters, you know, here in Bodhinyana Monastery, you know, that's, you know, who's that? That's Peng and and yeah, you two over there. There is many people have reported the ghost at those quarters, because you hear it. You hear it in the middle of the night, someone slipping outside your room. It's a kangaroo. And so many people have come up and said they heard it, someone walking outside of their room. Yeah.
Hearing that and interpret it that way.
Indeed, yeah. And all it is the kangaroos. It's just the way the kangaroos sound. And I've told many, many people that. And they think this, you know, it's a real ghost there. And all it is it's a kangaroo doing the kangaroo things. But the kangaroo sound, you know, you've seen the kangaroo, you know them now. But if you're just staying here for a short time, you don't know this. The kangaroo sound, the fear and the dread, it exaggerates your perception. And people are convinced this wasn't a kangaroo, it was the person walking. It could be like a stalker or a ghost or, you know, some crazy person knowing where the women's quarters are, coming to rape and kill all of you. But it's just kangaroos, and they don't do those sorts of things. They're kangaroos, for goodness sake. So that's happened many, many times. Anyway, where are we? Okay. So he didn't change his posture. Okay, and so 22. So really I think number 20, paragraph 21, seems to me it's been inserted in there. It doesn't really belong. It should really be paragraph 22, should have come straight after the paragraph 20. So tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness established my body was tranquil, untroubled, and my mind still and unified. Because this is when, you know, he just subdued the fear and dread. Because one thing with fear and dread, if you're in these places, you know, you do become quite mindful. It's almost like forcing you to become mindful, because you've got no choice, and forcing you to become still. And some of those old traditions, what was it, that one monk, the Ajahn Mun, in his biography, he took the monk to the tiger cave and sat them, you know, the tiger wasn't in the cave, and told the monk you had to sit here all night in the tiger cave. And of course the monk was meditating and the tiger came in. And he's, you know, this monk was in the cave where the tiger was. And he thought, you know, this is it, I'm going to die. But you know, the tiger just came in there and just, you know, washed itself and laid down and slept. And the monk just meditated all night. But you know, he wasn't no sloth and torpor. Perfectly mindful. So, you know, sometimes these things, they do actually get rid of your sloppiness of mind. You're really aware. So you can see, just like the Buddha said, tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established. And because of that, the body became tranquil and untroubled, the mind became still. And, I mention here that, just see that sequence, energy, mindfulness, tranquility of the body. Just the body just so at ease. And then the stillness of the mind. And of course, see what happens next. Paragraph 23. The first time in this Majjhima Nikaya, the description of the jhanas. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, as Ajahn Mari agrees now, that's not sensual pleasures, it's the five senses. Not just the pleasures, but everything to do with the five senses. Secluded from the five senses, secluded from unwholesome states, which refers to the five hindrances, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied not by applied and sustained thought. This is the movement of the mind onto the object and holding onto the object. There is no thinking there. Now the nice accurate translation, with the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And that particular seclusion is secluding from the five senses and unwholesome states. So once those five senses disappear and there's no hindrances, because they're a burden, they're a pain, you get the pleasure and the joy, because those things have finished. When the irritation has gone, oh, the feeling of peace, bliss, that is the sign of the first jhana. The piti sukha, the bliss and pleasure, or the rapture and pleasure, born of being secluded from the five senses and hindrances. Yes.
Can, In the Enlightenment Sutta, the Buddha recollected his time under the rose apple tree.
Yeah.
But this seems to think sort of be suggesting that he experienced jhana in his ascetic period.
It seems to be saying that, but it didn't really happen. I think whether this was a real anecdote beforehand or afterwards is really hard to say. So again, the chronology of this is difficult. But I think this is just going on to what would happen, you know, if other people would actually go into the jungle and face their fear, and they need to have that stillness, as it says in the beginning. Janasoni methinks that the jungle would rob the monk's mind if they didn't have this stillness of the jhanas. And the Buddha saying yes. So this is actually coming up to that.
What's the cause of tireless energy? Did you say I wasn't clear if you encouraged fear?
No, it seems to be because the Buddha had gone to those really scary places. And because it was going to seem to be arousing fear and dread, but then he decided to subdue it by not changing his posture, by not expecting fear and dread, just carrying on and just basically letting it go. And then because of that, tireless energy was aroused, mindfulness was established, body tranquil, and the mind became still, and then the jhanas. So it's almost saying that this is one way which it happens. If you have that purity of bodily, verbal, mental conduct and none of the other great defilements, you can go into those jungles, yeah, some fear and dread might seem to be coming up, but you'll subdue it, and because of that it will help establish mindfulness and energy.
And what are other ways, let's say, if sometimes it was slothful but it's not due to, if I need to have tireless energy, what are other ways to get that?
Tireless energy is just joy, inspiration.
Yeah,
because fear and dread is not the best way.
Okay.
Simply because, you know, you might lose a lot of disciples that way. If I told you to go and, you know, stay in the snake pit, you know, they'll get into the local papers and they think this is a really weird monastery. Amnesty International and the Human Rights Commission would put me in jail. So it's, you know, and again, there's this story again. It was the one of Ajahn Mun's disciples who always had lots of sloth and torpor, so he took him to this cliff, sat him on the edge and said, "You're going to sit here all night and you can't move." And because in those days, whatever the abbot said, you know, you'd have to follow that. So this poor monk thought he was going to die because he was always going to sleep when he was meditating, and he was sat to sit on the edge of the cliff. And he thought, this is it, death. So he just sat there all night, but of course he didn't die. Now those monks who did do that, who did die, we don't know about. We only know about the ones who survived. And now he got into a very deep meditation and actually didn't know really anything to do with time. When he opened his eyes, he'd missed the arms round. It was already mid-morning. So he got into a jhana. So some of those monks actually use this type of teaching to try and use, you know, the fear of death to actually to arouse unremitting mindfulness and energize you. And because of that story, when I was, again, the first year, in Wat Bawan they had this big building, this was in the centre of Bangkok, and the monks would actually go to the top story, actually to the roof, and sit right on the edge of the roof, you know, all night. And, you know, as soon as the abbot saw that, he realized, you know, these monks were trying to sort of follow that tradition. But if one of them, you know, fell off, that monastery would get into big trouble with the local embassy. So they actually locked the door so you couldn't get up on the roof anymore, because they were afraid the Western monks would fall off. So they tried all that sort of stuff, but, you know, they didn't work. Most of those monks disrobed anyway, so.
Ajahn, I have a question. In the Sutta, did the Buddha encourage any of this kind of meditation, like sit in the cliff or feel the, you know, stage of the high tree?
No, it doesn't seem to be. It's only this place where the Buddha said this is what he did. He went down to dangerous places, but that was just basically just in remote forests, not on the edge of cliffs.
And another question is, Prabhupada say that in order to get into a deep meditation, that you have to have a peaceful mind and a comfortable body.
Yeah, that's what the Buddha said afterwards. You know, that's the best way of getting into deep meditation, Eightfold Path, with a degree of comfort. But I think this was actually, it is true in the sense sometimes that, you know, when you really, the chips are down, you've got nothing else to do. Sometimes, you know, it is true that you can sort of arouse that, not so much the controller, but just, okay, you know, I really have to let go now, I've got no choice. So, you know, most of you are lazy. You know, if you really, you know, didn't have to, you won't. But if you really have to, it's amazing what you could actually achieve. You know, if we knew that this, you know, was the last moment of your life, the last evening of your life, and tomorrow the world is going to end, I think many of you probably get into nice meditation. But because you know it's not going to end, you can now meditate tomorrow and the day afterwards. If not the day afterwards, the next time you have time to come to Bodhinyana Monastery next year. So there is that sense of like laziness sometimes, and that's just nature. But it's true also that arousing fear it can be also dangerous. Some people just go crazy. So I don't think the Buddha really recommended that, except in this sutta he was actually talking about that's what he did. Yeah.
I noticed that in some places, like, there's a distinction between like what he teaches, so like he teaches,
yeah,
you know, Eightfold Path,
yeah,
and this is what you're okay, this is the way to get enlightened. And then there's other suttas where this happened and this is how that person got enlightened. And I noticed, I don't know if you can maybe just clarify this, but I noticed that some people, they interpret those stories that, oh, this is how this person got enlightened,
and
they kind of base their practice on that.
That's right, yeah.
It's like, it's clear to distinguish
if you
just follow what you taught.
Yeah.
Not get confused by what.
By the example, yes, yeah. I see what you're saying there. It's very true. I mean, the basic teaching which comes up again and again and again and again, not just these, you know, just every now and again you get something strange. The basic teaching, Eightfold Path, middle way, not do anything which tires the body or tires the mind. Yeah?
If you said that 23 continues on from 20.
Oh, yeah, from 22 fills up to 20, yeah.
That means to say that he did one of these spirit places and due to his mindfulness, he entered the first jar, is that right?
Yeah, it seems to be, yeah.
Jars until.
Exactly, that's what we're saying there. The chronology is a bit strange. Because it's also, it says here that. This is almost like a story of his enlightenment. So the three knowledges which came up. And almost it was actually saying this was his enlightenment. And this was not in Bodh Gaya, because this was supposed to be a scary place. Any one of you who have been to Bodh Gaya, you know that's not a scary place. And even in those days it was very pleasant and very calm. It was just close to a river. And you know, it's near enough to the village that, you know, Sujata would come there and just, you know, offer food. It's the last place you think would be very scary. So there is a chronological problem here. This is not the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, or it looks like it could be. So it's not the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, but I take this as being that this is the sort of thing which would happen. So not what happened to him, but the sort of thing which would happen if you go to those remote places. So, and with the stilling of that movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object, I entered upon abiding in the second jhana, which has the self-confidence, there's no self. So what that means is, again, that confidence in the object, you don't need to hold it anymore. So the vichara, which is the holding of it, disappears, and then the vitaka disappears as well. So that's without a pride or sustained movement of the mind. With rapture and pleasure born of stillness. Because that's what that state is, perfect stillness. Nothing is moving. So the vitaka vichara, which is a movement, has now disappeared. And the pleasure, the bliss of stillness. With the fading away as well as the rapture, half of that happiness, you abide in equanimity, mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body, Asgaja Brahmari, pleasure feeling with the body, it's called Kaya Pati Sangvedi. It is the idiom which means personal experience. Not sort of an idea, you're actually knowing this. The body's well disappeared. It's just one of those idioms which needs to be retranslated. You enter upon abiding in the third jhana, on account of which the noble ones announce they have a pleasant abiding, who is equanimous and mindful. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, which is the physical pleasure and pain, with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, which is the mental happiness and suffering, you enter upon abiding in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. I always like that purity of mindfulness to show that these jhanas are mindful states. They're not a state where you don't know what's going on. You know what's going on, but you can't explain it to yourself at the time. It's totally mindful. So the four jhanas, standard. When my still mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. And of course that must mean when you emerge from the jhanas, because in the jhanas nothing is malleable at all, not wieldy. And you can't do anything. So afterwards I directed it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. I recollected my manifold past lives, that is one birth, two births, three, four, five, six, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100, 1,000 births, 100,000 births, many hundred thousand births, many eons of world contraction, eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. There I was, so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifetime, and passing away from there I appeared elsewhere. And there too I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such was my lifetime, and passing away from there I reappeared here. Thus were the aspects and particulars I recollected my previous lives. This was the first true knowledge, or we might call it insight, it's vija, attained by me in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose, darkness was banished and light arose, as happened to who abides diligent and ardent and resolute. So this is now standard description of the Buddha's enlightenment. So it's as if like there's a chronological just disconnect there, where it's just, you know, saying beforehand when he was overcoming fear and dread, and that's not part of the usual Buddha's enlightenment, but now we're getting on to his enlightenment. And always mention that I know that some people like Stephen Batchelor now is saying the Buddha never taught rebirth, reincarnation, and look, it's absolutely ridiculous here that is one of the first true knowledges attained by me. So the Buddha obviously did teach reincarnation. It wasn't something which he took on board because everyone else believed in it. This was his own insights. And also, when my still mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. With a divine eye which is purified as the past as a human, I saw beings pass away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. I understand how beings pass on according to their karma. That's what the action is here, karma. Thus, these worthy beings who were ill-conducted in body, speech and mind, revilers of noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death have reappeared in a state of deprivation, in a bad destination, in perdition, even in hell. Now notice he even calls these people worthy beings. So it's very nice, it's very like this great politeness. These worthy beings who have done such bad things have gone to hell. They're still worthy beings. And these other worthy beings who are well conducted in body, speech and mind, not revilers of noble ones, right in their views, giving effect to right view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death have reappeared in a good destination, even in the heavenly world. Thus with a divine eye which is purified as the passes of human, I saw beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and I understood how beings pass on according to their karma. So the first watch of the night, understand the law of reincarnation or rebirth, the second, understanding karma.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Does this imply that you can only see your past lives after the fourth jhana?
No, first jhana is enough. If your mind is malleable enough, and imperturbable. And that, you've heard me say how it's done. You get into deep meditation and afterwards you say, what's my earliest memory? And see what comes up. And if you're lucky, you find out who you were before. So this is actually what's supposed to happen. This is actually how we find out. And the most, one of the important things about this, why it is an important part of enlightenment, is that when you see that this is not your only life, you live many, many, many times, it gives the full picture, the big picture of what suffering is. One life, I mean, you're pretty lucky, I mean, living at this particular time, you know, with good health care, good food, comfort, you know, you're not being tortured, you know, that this is a very happy time to live. This is close to a heaven realm. But it's not always like this. And next time it might not be so good. And if you actually remember all the other times you've been born, now you realise what you've got yourself into with getting reborn. This you've had a very lucky throw of the dice. Next time, who knows? So because of that, it gives you the big picture of life and death over many, many lives. And that big picture changes a lot of the way you look at life. So it gives the insight which changes the way that you perceive things. And then you understand how it happens, how you come to good destinations or bad destinations, how karma works. And that was the second true knowledge attained by me in the middle watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose. As happens in one who abides diligent, ardent and resolute. And I like that phrase too, because it doesn't mean that one who has great sort of talent like a Buddha, anyone, this is what happens in anyone who abides diligent, ardent and resolute. And now, when my still mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, manable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to knowledge of the destruction of the outflowings. I directly knew as it actually is. This is dukkha, suffering. I directly knew as it actually is. This is the origin of dukkha. I understood as it actually is. This is the cessation of suffering. And I directly knew as it actually is. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Okay, once you understand what suffering is in the sense of many, many lives, the first watch of the night knowledge, and understand that the cause of especially rebirth, the craving and the karma, then you actually have the Four Noble Truths. And then you understood the Four Noble Truths, and also this is the way into cessation of suffering. I directly knew it as it actually is. These are the outflowings of the mind. I directly knew as it actually is. This is the origin of those outflowings, why they go out into the world and create more birth and things. I understood, directly knew as it actually is. This is the cessation of the outflowings. I directly knew as it actually is. This is the way leading to the cessation of the outflowings. So sometimes the Four Noble Truths is put in terms not of suffering but the outflowings of the mind. Yes, your mind has outflowed.
Yeah. So the one before, it says ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. So that's not the like delusion that's abandoned at arhat, because it's only after the third one that it directed the mind to knowledge and destruction of the pain. So
exactly.
So that the ignorance before, that's just like
the ignorance relating to say rebirth.
Right, and that's necessary. So you can't basically do a shortcut to the third one, you've
got
to go through
1 and 2. It looks like you can, because sometimes people become enlightened without those Ouijas.
Yeah. You mentioned in a talk, actually, I think the last one, you said that you don't think it's possible to understand Buddhism for people to get fully enlightened without recognizing the past lives, because they
won't
understand the full
Buddhism.
But, like...
Yeah, you can, because... Yeah. I think that particular, you can't get fully enlightened through the full understanding of suffering, of dukkha, without remembering your past lives, but you can become enlightened through understanding non-self, mm-hmm. without going through those first two Ouijas.
So what if they go through, let's say, Nirodha, and they know that all of existence is suffering? Is that just to see, is that still possible to...
That is possible too, yes. But the thing is, if you get... your meditation is that strong, you get to Nirodha Samapatti, it's very easy to remember your past lives.
But you don't have to.
So you don't have to, but obviously you probably will. Okay. So having got that third knowledge, or that third insight of knowing the Four Noble Truths, when I knew and saw thus, my mind was liberated from the outflowing of seeking the five senses, from the outflowing of existing, of wanting to be, and from the outflowing of delusion, the three outflowings. When it was liberated, there came the knowledge it is liberated. This is cause and effect. Once you're liberated and enlightened, you know you're enlightened. And I like the word liberated, like freed. I directly knew birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. In other words, it's about to disappear. This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the last watch of the night. Delusion was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent and resolute. Now, Brahmin, it might be that you think perhaps the recluse Gotama is not free from lust, hate and delusion, the three kilesas, even today, which is why he still resorts to remote jungle-thinking resting places in the forest. Why do you put yourself through all that sort of harshness? You know, you're enlightened now, just take it easy. But you should not think thus. It is because I see two benefits that I still resort to remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest. I see a pleasant abiding for myself here and now. And that usually, pleasant abiding here and now, that usually refers to the jhanas. That's usually one of the descriptions of jhana. So he sees it's a jhana place. And I have compassion for future generations. In other words, if he does that, then other people will as well. And now, Jhana Soni is very impressed. Indeed, it is because Master Gotama is an accomplished one, a fully enlightened one, that he has compassion for future generations. Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama. Master Gotama has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. That's standard. And I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. From today let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge, for life. So you see here the three refuges. What are those three refuges? The Buddha, second refuge. The third refuge. No, what does it say? And sometimes it says Sangha of Bhikkhunis. I was pointing that one out because it's not the Sangha of lay followers, because sometimes, you know, these days people actually call themselves the Sangha, you know, like the Blue Glove Sangha or the Kalyana Mitta Sangha and other Sanghas. But in the suttas, this is both the Pali and the Agamas in Chinese, the Sangha which you go to refuge to is always a monastic Sangha. Sometimes the Bhikkhunis, sometimes the Bhikkhus, but monastic Sangha. Yeah.
Does this refuge mean, like, what's the point of how do we understand refuge? Because, like, my understanding of refuge for Dhamma is kind of different than refuge for Buddha, which is different than refuge for Sangha. So, how should we understand the meaning of refuge to help us practice?
I think that it means that even just recollecting those qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha is something which inspires you, which something which supports you, something which gives you the the inspiration and the vehicle to follow this path to the end. Yes?
Like in those refuges, is one also venerating a quality mind, like,
yeah, you can use that. You can use those in a less sort of material way. You can, you know, just what the Buddha means to you, what the Dhamma means to you, what the Sangha means to you.
Yeah.
Now, the Buddha, maybe you can interpret that as compassion or wisdom, and the Dhamma is like truth, and the Sangha is virtue. So there's many ways you can interpret that, but the way that it was usually mentioned in the term of refuge was actually something more physical. Yeah.
What motivates or why is an arahant going to jhana?
What motivates them? It's actually not. It's just when all the motivation finishes. That's the default state. I use that, you know, in terms of like computing. That's a new word. So when they're doing nothing else, then just that's what happens when everything else turns off. It's like, you know, the TV, you know, when it's just a blank screen. It's a default state. So that's like the jhana. That's what happens when you're still. The default state of the leaf on a tree is being still. It's only when the wind blows that it moves. So they don't motivate themselves to go to jhana. They've got to motivate themselves to get out of jhana and do something. Well, there's a really good simile which somebody told me years and years ago. And it was, you know, how birds can roost on a tree at night without falling off. Because birds go to sleep on the twigs, on the branches of a tree. And yeah, that's, you know, they're high up there. And sometimes there'll be a wind blowing and the tree sways all over the place, but the birds never fall off. Does that mean at night time all the birds are insomniacs because they have to grab on because, you know, they might fall off during the wind when the tree's rocking? And it was explained to me by someone who knows how birds work, that when the bird puts their claws on the tree, the more they let go, the more they relax, when they fall asleep, the claws actually dig closer in. And they have to put effort to actually open up the claws. So the more they let go, the more the claws close, the more stable they are. So it's only the paranoid birds who are just too worried, they can't actually let go enough to hold on, and they're the ones who fall off and die. But evolution has killed them a long time ago. So only the really relaxed birds, you know, actually survived. So it's nice. Now when you let go, you're still. When the bird lets go, it's safe. But when it starts to worry, you know, it can't sort of, you know, close up its claws enough to hold on. It's very beautiful. Letting go means things actually grab onto stillness. Sorry?
Fish sleep as well.
Okay.
They don't move,
okay. So they're relaxing, yeah. And they don't sort of, they don't sink, they don't go to the surface.
No, they don't seem to be aware of.
Oh. Do they snore? Couldn't. Yes, John. Either would do, but certainly for, he's a lay person, he's, that's basically not just go for refuge for a couple of days. He said, this is it, you know, you're my teacher, I go to refuge forever.
Enlightenment.
To enlightenment or till the end of the life until they forget. Mm-hmm. That's very nice. I mean, it's just, you know, these days we do ceremonies, you take the three refuges, and you, sometimes people take them every week whenever they come to the monastery. And to me that never made any sense, it's just a ceremony, but really you take them once and that's it. But it's also, it's very cute that when they do that, that Sompop, who you know, he always says, now we take the three refugees. I don't want to stop him saying that, cause it's so cute. Now we go for the three refugees and the five precepts. No. That's right. But sometimes when it gets just a ceremony, you know, you say that people know the Buddhang Saranangacchami, and there's no meaning to it. It's just sometimes you see them, Buddhang Saranangacchami, Dhammang Saranangacchami. And they're not really paying attention. There's no mindfulness, there's no meaning to it, because it's done too often. So It's not so nice. Well, yeah, I mean, so it's really good over in our Buddhist society that people go to to join as full members, they have to take the five precepts, they take them once and that's it. So they don't have to keep on taking them every week.
So there's no ceremony for becoming a Buddhist here?
No, of course not. You even just go up to a Buddha statue or just, in front of the tree somewhere, just Buddhang Samanangacharmi, and that's, that you're a Buddhist. That's your refuge. Okay, enough for tonight. I'm getting a bit tired.